Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Here with us in Studio 3 are syndicated columnist Reverend Irene Monroe and Reverend Emmett Price. He's professor of music at Northeastern University. Good to see you both.
Hey there.
Hello. Thank you for coming in. Okay, we're going to begin with something that Jim didn't want to talk about, which is unusual here. But he thought by talking about it, we would be elevating a person in a situation, giving it credence that it really shouldn't happen. Nonetheless, I'm plowing ahead here. This is Wolfboro, New Hampshire resident Jane O'Toole. She overheard the Wolfboro Police Commissioner, Robert Copeland, using the N-word in a restaurant. She talks about it here and also about a letter Copeland sent to her afterward confirming the incident.
It was not like I was eavesdropping on a table next to me or a table across the room. He was very loud. The letter really took the wind out of my sails, actually. It was an open admission of being racial.
And Copeland, this is the police commissioner, wrote the following back to Jane O'Toole.
No, this is, you're going to read
I read this. I'm sorry. I thought we had sound. I believe I did use the N-word in reference to the current occupant of the White House for this. I do not apologize. He meets and exceeds my criteria for such. So Jim, like I said, didn't want to talk about this because the guy's an old guy and he lives out in Wolfboro and it's not like he's in Washington, D.C. or something. Go ahead. Explain why.
If I remember correctly, we were discussing, and this I did bring up, we were discussing all those tweets that happened after that guy's Subban, the black hockey player from Montreal, scored. I think, Irene, you said something like, you know, shows that, and I'm paraphrasing, you'll correct me, shows that, you know, racism alive and well and that sort of thing. And then I thought about it afterwards and I said to myself, it doesn't show that racism is alive and well. It shows that there are a bunch of sick kids probably in their mother's basement. Well, this guy is a sick 80-year-old who is not the owner of a team with $1 billion. He's some loser in Wolfboro. And I said to myself, if we talk about this, which we are now doing, the implication it's going to leave is, God, racism is at every turn. And it may be, by the way, but I don't think that one lone ranger who obviously has a serious problem speaks to the issue of whether racism is rampant or not in this country. So am I right? And that was I, Marjorie, by the way, overruled my decision. We decided to do it anyway. Where do you fall on this, Irene Monroe?
I think you are hopelessly optimistic.
Okay. That's why I didn't want to talk about it.
I like the way you put that. Yeah. That sounds like something I would say.
He's not alone. He's not a lone racist. And interestingly enough, I mean, after a while, when you start tallying it up, we say Donald Sterling, we say this guy. After a while, you have a whole population, a whole town like Wolfboro, you know,
there were 100 and some people that showed up to this meeting to trash this guy the other night.
Absolutely. But what you have here is a very homogeneous community. This is a man that feels very, very comfortable, really very comfortable in displaying his racist behavior. So this is something to him. And I thought what would be interesting, most people, when you say, did you use the N-word, they have enough gumption to say,
exactly.
I either wasn't in my right mind, or did I say that? I didn't mean that. But interestingly,
or I didn't know I was being taped. Also,
the person he said it about. He's saying it about the sitting president of the United States, which I thought brought it to a higher level. To the N-word to describe Barack Obama, not that he was using it to describe anybody, but particularly Obama.
And not only that, I mean, it's almost like he's an HR person, right? Because he says that Obama meets and exceeds. Irene is right on the money here. You know, Jane O'Toole, who's the woman who overheard the conversation in the restaurant, she had just moved there 4 months ago. She didn't get the memo. She didn't know where she was moving into. And clearly she, you know, was shocked by it.
She
went back the next day to figure out. The issue is that this guy is a police commissioner.
Yeah.
And when she wrote to the local legislation to say, you know, how is it that we have somebody who's an official in our community who has this power, their response is, well, we don't have the power to remove him.
Because he's an elected official.
Because he's an elected official. So, I mean, here's the issue, you know, where you have somebody who's an elected official, you know, who can, you know, make a very nasty remark against a sitting president and can't be removed. Oh, my God.
Yeah,
well,
and
you know, but he's not an anomaly. Listen, this is a town that has 20 African American or people of African descent here. I'm going to play devil's advocate,
and I hate
we don't like the devil,
and I know.
Go ahead.
In our business, I don't know. But nonetheless, though, I think part of the problem, some of it do fall on us as African-Americans in that we use the N-word. See, no, Emmett and I go back and forth on that. But I do think that we're the only ethnic group of people that take such a derogatory and hateful word to turn on ourselves as a term of endearment. And we get angry. We get angry when we hear white folks use the N-word. And the thing that we fail to understand is that the American lexicon is a public enterprise. You can't divvy it up along race, class, or any other particular demographic group. So part of the problem is that we keep that word in circulation.
Yeah, but can I get back to my point for a second? In a couple of seconds, we're going to be discussing the 60th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education, which at least legally desegregated America's schools. Separate is not equal. However, let me read you a quote from Michelle Obama speaking to the 1,200 graduating high school seniors in Topeka, Kansas, which obviously gave birth, the city, to Brown versus Board of Education. Today, by some measures, our schools are as segregated as they were back when Dr. King gave his final speech. I want your thoughts on that in a second. But I would argue that because we have decided to elevate whatever his name is, Copeland, to a level that he does not deserve, and because I still believe he's an outlier. It's not because I'm denying his racism in this country. As a result, we are giving less play to what Michelle Obama is saying, which I would argue is a million times more important to poor kids and kids of color than what some nut in Wolfboro meant.
Well, yeah, it's really not an either or.
And you know what? I think it is an either or.
And I think you do damage when you don't recognize when someone like this gentleman or Donald Sterling are behaving badly like that. It does hurt to us as the group that it's targeted toward.
And Emmett Price just said the whole thing about how they can't get this guy out of there because he's an elected official. But the commissioner of the chairman of this commission board, he could at least ask this guy Copeland that used the N-word about the president to resign.
And he
says he's not.
Yeah.
So, you know, that says something bigger than just this one.
Because he can argue freedom of speech. Simple. I mean, like Donald Sterling and saying, listen, it's a private conversation. I didn't go up and...
Yeah, but you got all three of your, I think, missing where I am. And I couldn't...
No, we're not missing it. I think I am telling you, Jim,
the media has given as much play, if not more, to the travails of Wolfboro, New Hampshire, as they have in this past three or four days, to the travails of the public schools of the cities of America.
I so disagree because you make this assumption, Jim, that people of African descent don't experience people like a Donald Sterling and like this gentleman that's here in Concord,
Wolfboro, New Hampshire.
If anything, it makes him be held accountable for his hate speech because, truth be told, we hear it all the time.
Yeah, but I'm not denying that. I don't have that experience. I'm not denying it. What I think you're in denial about, in fact, all three of you are, and I'm most surprised Marjorie is, considering what she does for a living, there's only so much that the average person can take in an average day.
Just imagine.
All seem to be saying, let's list every atrocity every day. We'll throw all the balls in the air and the people will catch what they catch.
It gives you the magnitude and the kind of tsunami of assaults
confront. Let me say, I kind of agree with you, Jim. I mean, you know.
About time.
Here's a challenge. One is a reflection of the other, right? So when you have, you know, economic decay in inner cities, when you have, you know, jobs moving to different places, they create homogeneous and monolithic areas. You know, when you look at public schools in the country, the best public schools are in the most wealthy communities, which are not accessible to individuals who don't have the wealth and the means to live there. So when you look at this, you end up creating segmented and, if not segregated, communities based on wealth, based on privilege, based on, economic opportunities, which tend to reflect as kind of racial or ethnic bias.
Can I read these statistics to buttress this and then Irene Monroe? This is 60 years after Brown versus Board of Education theoretically began the process of desegregating America's schools. Today, according to the New York Times, 4 in 10 black and Latino students attend intensely segregated schools. The Federal Department of Education says only 14% of white students, 14%, attend schools that could be considered multicultural. which means 7 out of 8 white kids in this country essentially go to schools with all white kids.
Of course.
I mean, it is unbelievable.
But let's look at a more liberal school system like Cambridge school system.
I've heard of that school system, yes.
And it reflects the same kind of problems that schools across the country reflect. We pride ourselves as the people, you know, Republic of Cambridge, to be a lot more liberal. But interestingly enough, even though these kids will walk into the door and see people from all over the world, within that school system, systemically, they're tracked within grades, within attitudes that teachers and professors have of these students. You know, I'm a product of being bused and feel very scarred, although I went to Wellesley, Columbia, and Harvard. The emotional scar stays with you. And a classic example is this big sort of project at Harvard. I Am Harvard. These are kids who are the top of the top of all of in terms of college students, and yet they feel quite inferior to their not feel but are made to feel inferior to their colleagues. But I just want to use one quick example: the Boston busing crisis, the problem that we had here. We had Roxbury High, we had Boston High, and truth be told, both demographic group needed a leg up and a foot out.
Poor people,
and,
they right? To poor
and
people,
what they
and
did was is they confounded the factors by making it black and white, and the issue really was about class.
Right.
And so this is why there's a new theory, whether you agree with it or not, and I'm not saying that class is a proxy for race, that at times we have to look at regions where pockets of poor people
are. You know that class is a proxy for race in Cambridge public schools now. About
exactly.
A decade or so ago, they changed the criteria for this intra-city school choice. But Emmett, let's just stay on this 60 years after Brown versus Board of Education. I was saying to Marjorie when I was reading these numbers that we were discussing this morning, this is never going to get fixed. I mean, if you say to yourself 60 years after the fact that unless some ones are willing to step up to the plate and that bipartisanship replaces this grotesque gridlock that rules this country, what's the vehicle remain unfixed for more than half a century?
It will be fixed. I think it will be fixed.
Why? Before you answer this, did you go to public school or private school?
I went to both.
Okay, but what your senior year, where were you?
In high school?
Yeah.
Private school.
Okay, see, and I went to public school.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
See, and that may speak to it in and of itself. And what was the reason?
Bloods and the Crips.
Is that true? I guess there you go.
It was a reason.
But so tell me how we're going to fix this.
We'll fix it because when Michelle Obama made this commencement speech at his high school, my initial reaction was, this is so out of place. Great speech, love the message, but wrong place and wrong time. These high school kids, 17, 18, perhaps 19, had just spent all of their life going to school. This is the greatest day of their life, and they're ready to get to the party. They don't want any politics. They don't want to hear no speech by no first lady with all the cameras and all the stuff around. But then I thought about it. The way to heal the situation is to reach down deep into the next generation. Right? We're lost. We're absolutely lost. But if you reach down into the next generation and begin to contextualize some of the issues, right? Because her speech was really speaking to their parents, because most kids, like me, I didn't have a decision where I went to school. I didn't get to pick. Right? My parents made the decision based on the context and based on their desires for me to have a better opportunity than they did.
What we lose is this is what happened when they bust me out of my Bed-Stuy area.
But it's the
Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn for the few who don't know.
Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn, right. Bed-Stuy, do or die, right? but the interesting thing is it weakened the school board. It weakened the community. I spent every day an hour and a half just, you know,
commuting. It's ridiculous.
The emotional toll it takes to be received in a hostile environment and then to be tracked in the slowest track within a grade does far more emotional damage than to leave a child in a mediocre school
and
in
now
their
you're
community.
A leader
and
changing
me,
the world.
And let me finish this. And
that's
it's
a very
not
good
to
point,
say,
Emmett. That's a very good point. She overcame it to a certain degree, didn't she? That's right. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger,
right?
No,
not necessarily, but it's about luck. It's about a guidance counselor named Mrs. Eisenstadt, who, you know, but not everyone, you know, should.
Of course.
Yeah, it shouldn't be about a grab bag.
Well, but he was
interesting. There was an interesting quote in here by Zora Neale Hurston and by somebody else.
She was right on it, too.
Who was talking about the fact she worried that the integration in the schools, and which, of course, are not integrated anymore, would hurt the black kids because they wouldn't have the attention, the focus, and all that kind of stuff.
Here's the quote.
Yeah, how much satisfaction can I get from a court order for somebody to associate with me who does not wish me to be near them? She's talking about what you're talking about. But you know where I think it's hopeful? I think it's hopeful because I think nothing's ever going to happen in Washington anymore in my lifetime. But some of these mayors, you get a guy maybe like a de Blasio in New York who might see that the New York schools are in such disastrous straits that maybe you can do some fixing. I don't know. I don't know how you convince somebody that lives
in... Well, I mean, you have to look at it from this perspective. Right. Brown versus Board of Ed was more about desegregation. It was not about integration. Right. And so that's a myth that we have to deal with. It was not about integration. It was about desegregation. So when you desegregate, there's an assumption that one population will benefit greatly from being accepted into or being merged into or being, you know, able to come into another. And one of the challenges was that people who face systematic oppression and trauma on a daily basis figure out how to survive. And African-American communities figured out how to create educational systems, how to create historically black colleges and universities. They figured out how to use the church as an economic engine, political engine, in order to make access for opportunity for people. They figured out. We figured out. And so the question was, you know, the desegregation, what do you lose and what do you gain? I think when we do a postmortem autopsy and look at it from both perspectives, I think we'll see where some of the decisions were wrong. I think we'll see where some of the individuals who made decisions were wrong, and we'll be able to correct that path.
Yeah, but I hate to be a nattering nabob of negativism or what Spira Agnew said, but in our last couple of minutes here, Irene Monroe, is if 60 years got us this far, which is not that far.
It's not far at all.
So we lose another 2, 3, 4 generations while the next de Blasio or the next de Blasio.
Well, that's why people
What's
are looking
the
at
big
alternatives.
Idea?
That's what people are looking at alternatives. They're looking at schools which have different rules and schools which operate in different ways. But, you know, you have to find a way to change the funding of schools, frankly.
That's right.
Because in Boston, you had the white flight out of the city.
That's
and
right.
You had people that didn't have the tax base. And so you had those kinds
but
of problems.
But the one model's not going to work everywhere. And I agree with you, Marjorie, but the one model works in Newton. It works in Brookline. It just doesn't work in Roxbury and Dorchester because of the flight, because of the talented 10th, right? Those, you know, top 10% of the African-Americans who also move out of the hood and do the whole brain
drain. Okay, so you know, this gets back to what I said about a lack of optimism on my part. If the governor and the legislature stood up tomorrow and said, in light of that flight issue, we're no longer going to have school districts in cities and towns. We're going to have regional school districts. So, for example, the Greater Boston School District includes Newton, Brookline, Cambridge, whatever. I mean, the reality is that would begin to address a lot of the concerns we're talking about.
The economic and educational inequity.
How many of the 200 legislators do you think on Beacon Hill would vote for that thing?
They're not going to vote for
that.
Of course not.
Constituencies
would move.
Exactly. So my point is, and I don't want to be negative because we all agree, I assume, the single most important thing to change the world is a decent K-12.
I agree.
With people having a decent opportunity.
But it's not a legislative... It's not a legislative fix. It's a human nature fix.
Well, but I think you should let the community...
The fix is when we understand each other as being, citizens of the same community.
That's not
I mean,
work.
You know, that's what fixed
healthcare. That's kumbaya here.
You know, legislature didn't fix the healthcare situation.
Yeah,
it was individuals being connected to other people.
But
who
one
are
of
suffering.
The ways they get connected, despite what Irene... We only have a minute left. What Irene Monroe said about how even Cambridge, which is as multiracial as a city school system probably gets...
With buku money.
She's mentioning all the... That's correct. Per pupil expenditures. She's mentioning all the flaws. And while we don't have enough time to debate the flaws or lack of flaws, the fact that kids of all different races and all different economic backgrounds, at minimum, are sitting in the same room together and are experiencing each other, in my estimation, is a huge step up. It doesn't mean all the problems are not solved.
But you have to ask those kids, because some of those kids know that they're from Area 4.
I understand
and the stigma that carries.
And you are never going to get the people with the money to do that.
That's
it's
exactly
right. It's always going to be
kids who take the bus versus kids who walk to Cambridge, Ringe, and Ladder. So, I mean, you have this kind of fractioning that's going going on, even in an idyllic place like Cambridge, Ringe, and Latin.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying it is a huge leg up.
But I think
than one of these 40% schools where, again, 4 in 10 Black and Latino students attend intensely segregated schools, is the term of art from the Federal Department of Education. They don't even have a chance to experience other people. Forget all the other stuff that you and I'm sure everybody thinks needs to be done to have a decent school system. Well, that's a hell of an anniversary for Brown versus
Board of really, 60 years later.
It's a disaster.
Can you guys come back for the 70th and we'll see if we're...
Sign me up, Jim.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's great
We'll see, because you have a kid. By that time, we'll see how
talking
it's
Emmett?
Worked.
We'll trade seats. We'll put Emmett the 4th in here instead of Emmett the 3rd.
Why don't you attack him and say he's going to send the kid to private school so it won't matter.
Okay. Reverend Irene Moreau is a syndicated columnist. You can find her at Bay Windows in the Huffington Post. The Reverend Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture Toward Bringing the Generational Divide. Great to talk to you guys, as always. Up next, we're going to ask you about the bread basket. Where did it go? And what happened to the bottomless bowl of nuts at the bar and those mints that they used to give you on the way out the door? How those free perks that used to come with eating out now cost us money? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.